All right, so we're starting out in chapter 8 and verse 4. We see Jeremiah just befuddled by Israel because they are backsliding. We know that Josiah has tried to turn the country around, what's left of the country, but his limited sphere of influence is just not stopping the Israelites, who have had generations of idolatry and corruption and divisiveness, deceit, lying, falling away from the Lord. And we see that Jeremiah is just utterly frustrated with the Israelites that remain in and around Jerusalem and all over Judea. The first question I asked was, what made Judah worse than horses, turtle doves, and swallows?
No man repented of his wickedness.
Yeah. So they did not do that which Yahweh had put in their hearts, which is to say that he gives examples of the animals, how they instinctively know what to do. The stork in the sky knows her seasons, the turtle dove and the swift and the thrush observe their times of migration. But my people don't know the ordinances of the Lord. God put these things in the hearts of these animals. We call it instinct, but they know what to do and they do it. God equally created us in his own image, shared his mind with man, either by direct communication or through his word. But Judah rejected God, rejected his ordinances, and rejected the covenant which they had made with God, to which they swore. And they did it to follow their own desires. So we start out in chapter 8 here, looking at Jerusalem and the Judeans doing just this thing that they can't do if they want to remain a nation, and that is just absolutely turning their backs on God. So how can you say, this is the Lord, how can you say we are wise and the law of the Lord is with us? Again, we've heard this several times through our study. That is the Israelites saying that the Lord is with them, even though they're not worshiping the Lord properly, even though they don't love the Lord, but they think because they have Jerusalem and because they have the temple that the Lord is with them, because they're living within their walled city, the Lord is with them. And because they think they're wise, because they've devised these different things to try and hold off the Assyrians first and then the Babylonian army, they think that they're impenetrable.
They have false
So, who
prophecies.
is. Yeah, what's that?
They have false prophets too to help them along in believing that.
Absolutely. Not only false prophets, but the priests are corrupted. The kings and princes are corrupted as well, looking out for their own interests, trying to make themselves rich, as we'll read about later on in this study tonight. So who is leading the people away from those ordinances? And like Faye said, the prophets and priests, they're the wise men of Israel. And these wise men are the scribes, the prophets, the priests. They all are practicing deceit, and they're leading the people into oblivion. Because we've read recently about the things that they're going to be dealing with in their near future. And we've read about desolation. We've read about the land being desolate. And tonight We're going to read about the word annihilation. There's just going to be nothing left. The Lord is not going to treat them well. He is going to allow his will to be done by the Babylonians, because the people have earned his wrath. They have scorned him, and they have committed adultery against him by chasing after false gods. So we're going to read in verse 13 where the Lord says, I will surely snatch them away, declares the Lord. There will be no grapes on the vine, no figs on the tree, and the leaf will wither, and what I have given them will pass away. So in verse 13, what would Judah's fate be?
Poverty.
Absolutely. The loss of everything that means anything to them. Their land is going to be destroyed, going to be given to others, or just neglected beyond usefulness. And the people are going to be led away into harsh captivity. And when we say harsh captivity, we're not talking about being put in a nice little cozy jail cell. We're talking about the people being slave labor and being abused by the country that they live in. They won't be treated well. They will be treated as second and third hand citizens of that country. And very few of the Israelites who are taken to Babylon are treated well. We read about Daniel and his friends, and they were treated well because they were the cream of the crop in Israel. But the layperson in Israel, those who are hauled away with fish hooks in their noses and their cheeks, aren't going to be treated well. They're going to be treated horribly, and they're going to be slave labor for the Babylonians. And they're going to be slave labor for 70 years. So they're looking at a pretty harsh rest of their lives. For many of the people who are in their teens, they're not going to make it out of Babylon. For those who are younger, they might remember the captivity, being carried away from Israel, and then coming back when the Israelites are allowed to come back to the land after the Persian Empire takes over and crushes the Babylonian Empire. But for most of the Israelites who are taken into captivity here from Jerusalem and Judea or Judah, it's going to be just a lifetime of servitude and slavery. So, what was the Lord sending among the people?
Snakes, serpents.
I am sending serpents against you, adders for which there is no charm.
All right. So, I pulled up a near and dear picture for all of us.
Oh, no.
For some reason always brings it back to me. The Indiana Jones movie, when he goes down in the Raiders of the Lost Ark and he drops into that pit and there's just nothing but adders and vipers. All of these snakes, and the only thing stopping them from coming at Indiana Jones are just those few torches that he has. And that's scary enough for all of us. But yeah, the Lord says he's going to send serpents, more to the point, adders. And what do we know about an adder? Well, it's poisonous and it's deadly. And that's what the Lord is saying. The army that I'm sending against you is going to poison you. And that is going to take away everything that you know, going to make your life miserable. And they're going to kill many, many of you. And the idea of that very poisonous adder coming at you is something that you will never forget for sure. And that's the picture that Jeremiah was trying to get Judah to see, is there is a reckoning coming that is going to lay waste to us. It's going to kill us, just like a very poisonous snake would. But the idea that they could survive this, even though the Lord said he would not utterly destroy them, he would not annihilate them, but he is going to annihilate their country. There's going to be nothing left of it. And when the Babylonian army is done with Jerusalem, there will be nothing standing. The wall will be completely down. The temple will be destroyed. All of the temple wares, furniture, the things they use to worship God, gone. Babylon will take that along with the people into captivity.
I think, too, that Ted, it speaks of the Valley of Hinnom, and that their bones, this is the place where they passed their children through the fire, killed all their children, offering sacrifice, and their bones are going to be left there as well and won't be buried. They'll just be left to the scavengers.
Exactly, and that's what we're going to see later on here. He'll touch on that. But also, we know that from last week's study that the Israelites themselves were pulling bones of their ancestors out and using those to worship the sun, moon, and stars. Things that were foreign and grotesque to God that he never asked them to do. And they were practices that they had picked up from the peoples around them. The reason that the Canaanites were utterly destroyed out of the land was because they were practicing these kind of things. And not even the countries around Israel and Judah were doing this child sacrifice kind of stuff. It was grotesque to even them. Israel had taken it a step further and was doing things that were utterly incomprehensible to their king, who is God. So we see Jeremiah just absolutely grief-stricken when he starts to reveal these things to Israel. So why was Jeremiah mourning? And it looks like I forgot to not give you my answer, but go ahead.
They provoked the Jeremiah, or they provoked God with graven images.
Absolutely. Jeremiah could see the sickness of the land around him consuming the Israelites. And there was nothing that he could do to heal the people. Nothing anybody could do to heal the people. Josiah tried his very best. And for 31 years, the people had one last stint of peace, but only because of the righteousness of Josiah. And only because he did his very best to wipe out what his father and grandfather had done to the land. They had corrupted it beyond recognition to God. And the people were worshiping idols, sacrificing their children to idols, sacrificing in the high places rather than at the temple of God where they should have been. All of these things were leading to their utter destruction.
Hey, Ted.
Jerusalem. Yeah, Dean.
As I was reading this, I get the impression that 18 and 19 is what Jeremiah says to God. And he's pleading with God, "You who are my comforter in sorrow, my heart is faint within me." And then he gets down to the end. He says, "Is her king no longer there?" It's as if Jeremiah says, "Don't you still care about your people?" And then God's response is in the last part of verse 19. "They've aroused my anger with their images." It's right. As if I cared, but they just wouldn't listen. I did everything I could. And I'm reminded of Jesus' statement about Jerusalem in Matthew. He says, "How many times would I have gathered you under my wings as a hen gathers her chicks to protect them, but you wouldn't listen."
Exactly. And if you look down Let's see. Behold, listen, the cry of the daughter of my people from a distant land. I get the impression there that Jeremiah is talking about not current Judah, who's not in captivity, but the northern 10 tribes that have been hauled away by the Assyrians and were now under Babylonian captivity because Babylon had conquered Assyria. And he says these almost all of the tribes are gone. They're in captivity, crying out for the Lord, who will not save them because they utterly deserted God. There was not a good king in the northern 10 tribes the entire time after the divided kingdom. And the Lord gave them up. He gave them up to captivity into first Assyria and then Babylon. And then they would be in captivity with the Medes and Persians to the point where most of the northern 10 tribes would be unrecognizable. Even those who did come back from captivity wouldn't be the same people. They had been in captivity for over 100 years now. And they're starting to blend in with the peoples of the land where they're being held captive. And although we know that Judah is going to be in captivity for 70 years, we know that for Israel, for the northern 10 tribes, for Ephraim, it was much longer than that. They were in captivity for almost 200 years. And think about that. Our country has been around for 240 years. So how recognizable would those northern 10 tribes really be after 200 years of not having the center place of spiritual worship that is Jerusalem? And they had given that up even further along than that. But not having that, being surrounded in their own, in the country they are living in, by idolatry, by the manners and the gods of that country, whom the Jews had shown themselves to be very willing to take on, and that is to give up on the Lord and to start worshiping idols. And now they're not even in their own land anymore. So in my opinion, I think verse 19 is also talking about those people from a distant land. It could be referring to a future event that's going to happen to Judah, and that's where prophecy comes in. But I think for the people at that time, Judah or Jeremiah could point north and say, we already know that we lost 10 tribes. We lost them to Assyria. They're gone. We can hear their cries to the Lord, but the Lord isn't listening. And the tribe of Judah and the Levites were descending into deprivation with no way out except annihilation, which is the word that'll be used later on in this chapter. So Jeremiah is just grief-stricken because the Lord seems to have given up on Judah and Jerusalem, and he just doesn't understand it. He doesn't know why God would do that. We've got a good king, Josiah's turning things around, but the people's hearts are not turning. They have given up. And the Lord says, why do they provoke me with their graven images, with foreign idols? Josiah is doing the right thing, and because of his righteousness, I am not bringing wrath upon you yet. But the people are still not worshiping me. They're worshiping their foreign gods.
Hey, Ted, I was kind of comparing this to the book of Habakkuk, which in many ways deals with kind of the same period of time. And while I think Jeremiah understands that the people have rejected God, I think Jeremiah is dismayed that the judgment that's coming upon them is so serious. When you get down to verse 21, and 22, he says, my people are crushed. I'm crushed. I mourn. Horror grips me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there? It's almost as if he's saying, is there nothing that we can do? And this destruction that you're bringing is so terrible that I think even Jeremiah, he may have understood that God needed to bring his wrath on the people that had rejected him. But this was in Jeremiah's thinking, this was overboard. This was a harsher sentence maybe than was deserved.
And I can understand that, but he doesn't have to look that far to find out the sentence that Israel got 100 years before that. And the people of Judah weren't doing any better. In fact, they were starting to do worse. So punishment is never fun. And especially punishment for these kinds of crimes against your fellow man and against your children, basically against God himself. And there's no way out of it unless these people were to completely change their hearts, which the Lord knew just wasn't possible. There had been too much time and too much destruction in the country by Manasseh. He had pulled the people too far away.
Ted, I think that Jeremiah knew exactly what was going to happen to the people of Judah. And I think he was not only lamenting the problem, but he was begging God to not bring his wrath on them. He saw it coming, and he couldn't do anything about it, and yet he still mourned for them. And God told him not to mourn for them. Their fate is sealed.
Right. Yep. When we introduced this book, when Jeremiah started prophesying, God had already made up his mind. The kingship of Manasseh had utterly ruined any chance that Judah had of escaping wrath. Manasseh's first, let's say, three quarters of his kingship before he was hauled into captivity and humbled himself before God had done so much damage to the country, had polluted it so much that there was just nothing that anybody could do to bring it back. The people were so corrupt and so much idolatry had been introduced into the country that there was just nothing left but people who wanted to worship idols. The righteous were few and far between. And as we talked about two studies ago, comparing Jeremiah finding one righteous person in Jerusalem to Abraham trying to find 10 righteous people in Sodom. And he couldn't do it. The people were looking out for themselves only, not their neighbor, lying to each other, being deceitful. And we'll get into that here in chapter 9. So the next question is, why did Jeremiah want to take up residence in the wilderness?
Wanted to get away from all that sin.
Absolutely. The sin and the treachery of the Israelites had become so horrible that he wanted out of it. He wanted nothing to do with it. He said that I might leave my people and go from them, for all of them are adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men. He just didn't want to have anything to do with those people because of how horrible they were to each other and to him.
He wanted to live out in the remote desert country that was very, very uncomfortable, and would rather do that and be away from the people rather than live in that mess.
Absolutely. And you can't blame him. You know, if I was being exposed to people sacrificing their children onto a stone statue with flaming, you know, with basically altars in his hands, I wouldn't want to be any part of that. I'd want to get out of there just the same amount that he would. And hopefully that had been taken care of by Josiah. But again, the people's hearts were turned. They did not seek after the Lord. They sought after their own gain.
Ed?
Yeah.
When somebody you love is bent on the way to destruction, it is so hard to have to watch them walk down that road. You can see where they're going. They can't see it. And because he was with God and he mourned them, he would rather be out and away from them in the wilderness. He didn't want to see their destruction, I think.
Right. And to the point where in this next question, why were they commanded not to trust their brother?
Because they did not speak the truth. They deceived everyone they spoke to.
Yeah, in chapter 9 and verse 4, it says, let everyone be on guard against his neighbor and do not trust any brother, because every brother deals craftily and every neighbor goes about as a slanderer. You couldn't go anywhere without somebody bad-mouthing you, without talking behind your back, without treating you poorly, without trying to rob you or steal from you. Or imagine trying to buy a house or trying to buy cattle or anything like that, where the person you're trying to have a deal with has nothing but your worst intentions in mind, who's going to do everything they can to try and swindle you. And we see Jeremiah telling us that everyone deceives his neighbor and does not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. They weary themselves committing iniquity. I can't imagine a worse place to live than with these people, with the way he describes them. Their tongue is a deadly arrow. It speaks deceit. With his mouth, one speaks peace to his neighbor, but inwardly he sets an ambush for him. I mean, this is just the worst of the worst politics we've ever seen in our country, and it was everyday life for them. It was every man for himself. And the Lord finally says in verse 9, shall I not punish them for these things? On a nation such as this, shall I not avenge myself? The Lord sees people who may have a decent heart being treated horribly by their neighbor and their brother, being swindled, being beaten, and being treated unfairly. And the Lord wants nothing to do with the majority of the people in Judah whose hearts are not with him. So what would be the result of Judah's rejection of Yahweh?
Desolation.
Absolutely. Utter destruction. Desolation of the land, desolation of the pastures, of the vineyards, of the orchards, of the livestock. In verse 10, we read that the pasture and the wilderness are a dirge because they laid waste so that no one passes through. You don't hear the cattle. Both birds of the sky and beasts have fled. They are gone. I mean, you don't have anything living in this country anymore. It's all gone. Nothing left. The pasture lands are destroyed, so you can't even raise your cattle or your herds. There's no food. or not enough to sustain yourself. All of the walled cities have been destroyed. So there's nothing left to protect you from the myriad of outsiders who want to take this land of milk and honey. And Israel still had many enemies surrounding them. The Moabites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, all of these, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, all of these countries were daily taking land. Babylon was the biggest of them all. It had taken everything except for parts of Judah and Jerusalem. And even those were living on borrowed time. But we see a word picture here in verse 10 of just utter desolation in the land and nothing left to live for. No reason to even want to live there.
They've been on this path since they left Egypt.
Absolutely. Since the first time they started murmuring against God. And they paid the price for it then. And now they're paying the ultimate price. They had, when they initially came out of Egypt, they weren't under a covenant yet. They hadn't made that covenant with God. But when their fathers made that covenant and repeated the blessings and the curses that would come if they broke that covenant, they were seeing the curses come upon them, paying the ultimate price for the things they had done by turning away from God. So the next question I asked is, how does Yahweh answer the question as to why the land is burned up?
Well, I see it in verse 13. The Lord said, it's because they've forsaken my law that I set before them. They have not obeyed me or followed my law. Instead, they followed the stubbornness of their hearts.
Right. Went after the Baals as their fathers had taught them. And this is a direct dig at Josiah's father and grandfather and the kings before them who did not follow after the heart of David, who did not encourage the people to follow God. And the stubbornness of their own heart going after idols, the Lord says, behold, I will feed them, this people, with wormwood and give them poisoned water to drink. Is that how a God talks to his people? It is when they've broken their covenant. Because they no longer have a covenant with God. They have surrendered that covenant and now are reaping the curses of a broken covenant. God goes on to say, I will scatter them among the nations whom neither they nor their fathers have known. And I will send the sword after them until I have annihilated them. He's planning to completely destroy this people. There will be a remnant. There will be those who survive, but it's going to look nothing like what they had when they came into the land. They will never be the pinnacle of theocratic power that they were when Caleb successfully trounced the Canaanites. They will never be a power structure in this land again. They will live there, but they will always be under the yoke of slavery. After Jerusalem falls this first time, that will be the end of the Israelites controlling their own destiny because they gave up on God, because they forsook him. God let them go. and gave them to the nations around them.
Ted, it seems to me that, you know, as bad as people are when they don't know God, it's even worse once we've known God and we've established a relationship with him to then give up on that relationship. And there's a big sense in which I think that that those who are Christians and who leave God face up a much sorer punishment than people who have never known God in the first place.
Agreed, to the point that Jesus gives us a nice word picture about that. That's the dog returning to its vomit and the sow returning to the mire. I mean, you can't think of things that are just worse than those word pictures that we get in the New Testament of people who have fallen away, who have known God, who have committed themselves to him, and then have made the choice to turn their backs on God.
This paints a picture of judgment to us. If we fall away, if we don't put God first, we are going to reap the same as what the children of Israel received.
Right. So why were they to teach wailing to their daughters and lamentations to everyone?
Death is coming to everyone, children, sons, everyone.
Yep. They were going to witness the death of children, the death of their young men, cut down in their prime by this very harsh army that was coming to utterly destroy them. To the point where what Ron talked about, the corpses of men would be like dung in the open field, left to rot for the beasts and the birds. That doesn't specifically say that in this verse, but we're told that a few chapters ago, that the men are going to be cut down and that they will not be buried. Their bones will not be put away. They will be left for the beasts of the field and for the birds to pick at. It's just a picture of utter destruction, of the harshest punishment. But this is a punishment that was hundreds of years in the making. They're 400 years away from David, and they have fallen from grace to the point where they are no longer recognizable as God's chosen people. And God cannot have that. He's a righteous God. He is a just God. And he will treat them with the justice they deserve. So what were the people to boast in? Old King James calls it glory in, but it's really the idea is to boast in this. And so what did the Lord say that they should be boasting in?
Love, justice and righteousness.
Exactly. We are told in verse 24 to let him boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am Yahweh who exercises loving kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth. For I delight in these things, declares the Lord. And those who survive will remember these qualities of their loving Heavenly Father as they endure 70 years of captivity. These people are just starting on that journey. They're not in captivity yet, but it's coming. And those who survive the onslaught of the Babylonians, those who aren't outright killed when the Babylonians take Jerusalem and all, and the cities in Judea. Those who are taken off into captivity are going to remember what the Lord told them, that he is a just God, that he exercises loving kindness, and that he is righteous. And they're going to spend 70 years begging for mercy. So to round out the chapter 9, in what way was Israel considered uncircumcised?
I think God was referring to their uncircumcised heart.
Exactly.
They were talking about 26. other countries around them had certain physical circumcision as well. They weren't any different in that respect. A lot of them weren't. I think the Philistines were the only ones that didn't practice it, but he was talking about their heart.
Yeah. He says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, that I will punish all who are circumcised and yet uncircumcised. So Egypt and Judah and Edom and the sons of Ammon and Moab and all those inhabiting the desert who clip the hair on their temples. For all the nations are uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel are uncircumcised of the heart. We know that the Jews were unique in that circumcision that God commanded of Abraham, and that was part of their covenant. But that physical circumcision is not what God was looking for. He wanted a heart that had been tuned to follow him. And the scales of justice on one side is God's mercies, his grace, and his forgiveness. And then God's wrath is on the other side. And the people were earning God's judgment. They had for 400 years accumulated the wrath of God by provoking him to jealousy and to anger with idolatry and sin. And so I said it reminds me a lot of when I was teaching Galatians chapter 3 and verse 7. Just that one verse is all I was going to read. It says, therefore, be sure that it is those who are of the faith who are the sons of Abraham. That is, it doesn't matter about physical circumcision to God. Just like sacrifices that he commanded didn't matter to God. If you weren't doing it with the heart to serve God, if you weren't doing it not out of rote, but out of love for God. And if you were, what he recognized of these people is that they were uncircumcised. They did not put him first. They put themselves first. They did not put their neighbor first. They put themselves first. They were doing everything they could to make themselves wealthier, to look out for themselves, to not look out for each other, and definitely not to look out and serve their God. So if you look at chapter 8 and verse 10 through 12, those read almost exactly the same as chapter 6 and verses 12 through 15. Why would something be repeated like this?
To get his point across, to make it's an important point to
I'd agree. And as we've heard before, repetition, repetition, repetition. We are humans, and humans, even those of us with great memories, have terribly short memories when it comes to things that we may not absolutely love. When it comes to things that don't tickle our fancy. When it comes to things that don't tickle our ears. We're terribly short-sighted and short-minded. The Lord knows that. And so the things that are important to him, he repeats. And he'll repeat them time and time again. And we see in chapter 8 and verses 10 through 12 being almost a word-for-word repetition of chapter 6, verses 12 through 15. Well, he's reminding them of the people they have become. Everybody's greedy for gain. From the prophet, even to the priest, everyone practices deceit. In chapter 6 and verse 12, he says the same thing. From the least of them to the greatest, everyone is greedy for gain. He says, even from the prophet to the priest, everyone deals falsely. And he reminds them in both sets of verses that they're not ashamed of any of the abominations that they have done. And that they had forgotten how to blush, or they did not even know how to blush. To the point that their consciences were seared, that they did them no good. In chapter 9 and verses 3 through 6, Jeremiah describes the deceit and lies of the people of Judah. And so the question is, how important is honesty in our lives?
In Proverbs 6, God hates a lying tongue.
Absolutely. If we're looking to serve God, honesty is an absolute necessity. But even more than that, I think we've all experienced what it feels like to have somebody lie to us. To have somebody say they're going to do something and then not do it. We know how that feels. And we have experienced that ourselves. How important is honesty in our lives today? You don't have to go much further than to turn on the radio anymore during this political season and hear lies. Things that you know are lies. And it's, for me, for a lot of those things, it makes me angry to hear that, because you have people who will just bold-faced lie. Because they're looking out for themselves and not for their neighbor. And they're definitely not looking out for God to serve him.
What comes out of your mouth is what you're going to be judged on.
Absolutely. That is the truth. And as Faye said, God hates a liar. And if you've made it a staple of your livelihood or of your life to lie to people, that's going to be part of your judgment, because God hates lying. So what things ought we to boast in then? And what things should we not boast in? In verses 23 and 24, God gives us a list of things that the people were boasting in and the things that he thinks are important. So what things ought we to boast in?
The Lord's loving kindness, his justice and righteousness.
Okay. So we see that in the Lord, and we have examples of Paul in the New Testament boasting of certain things as well. And Paul boasted in the things that he had accomplished because of God. not because of what he had done, but because God had given him the ability to do those things. So we ought to boast in exactly what God tells us to. We boast in the fact that God has given us the ability to take the word to other people, that we live in a free country that God has given us. We ought to boast in the fact that we have the knowledge that we do because God gave us his mind, because God gave us free will and the choice to make, the choice to bring others to him, to make God a priority in our lives. And then to exercise what he exercises, that is loving our fellow man, being just with our fellow man, and doing what is right. And we ought not boast in things that are going to elevate ourselves. God says, let not a rich man boast in his riches. Let not a wise man boast in his wisdom, and let not a mighty man boast in his might. We're all given talents, things that we can do well, but we don't need to boast in those things. God gave us the ability to take care of ourselves, and some of us are better at certain things than others, but that's not for us to boast in. That's an accomplishment that we achieve because God led us. We should boast in the fact that we get to help others, that we get to point them in the direction of God, that we get to point them in the direction of living a righteous life and of being just to our neighbors. Those are the things that we should boast in.
Ed, go ahead. I'll make a point when you're finished.
And that we understand and know the Lord. And then it comes to, rather, we are known by God.
Absolutely.
You know, Ted, I was thinking about a conversation that I was a part of a long time ago, but a man was bragging about the fact that he had gone into a store and the shopkeeper had failed to turn the signs around after he had had things on sale. And so he went in and he found some, I think it was Nike tennis shoes that had been marked down, and the shopkeeper meant for the sale to be over. And he was boasting that he had put one over on the shopkeeper, and he managed to get the shopkeeper, get one over on the shopkeeper. And I thought, you know, that's boasting in something that we really shouldn't be boasting in. I would rather boast in the fact that the shopkeeper charged me too little and I returned to him what I should have paid.
Right. Justice, that is honesty, goes back to the question we just answered. How important is it to be honest and to be just with our fellow man? We're learning, I think, one of the things that Jeremiah teaches us, even us today, is how important honesty is and how important it is to live righteously towards God. And it's not just that we need to be scared of God. We should fear God because he is the creator of everything. But we should want to serve him because he is God. He created us in his image. And as he told Jeremiah, I knew you before you were born. And we should remember that. The last question I have for you tonight is, when we stand before God in final judgment, what can we be guaranteed of? And this goes back to the lesson that we had, I think, last week, Dean.
That he'll judge us righteously.
Absolutely. But that God is not a respecter of persons. He is going to, his standards don't change. He's going to judge Adam the same way he would judge Abraham, the same way he would judge David, the same way he would judge Josiah, the same way he would judge Paul, the same way he would judge you and me. He does not show partiality. He is an impartial judge. And although many of those examples lived under different covenants in very different times in the history of our planet, one thing stands out, and that is that God set rules for mankind to follow. And we are judged based on how we live our lives, what we do with the time that we are given, and who we put first in our lives.
We don't live on a planet. Jude said we will be presented faultless before the presence of the Lord with exceeding joy. That's one thing we're guaranteed of.
So it's important to just remember that we should always be looking out for our fellow man and to serve God in any way that we can with our lives. To always put the word of God first in our lives and to do what we can to serve. Now, we are told in the new covenant that we are saved by grace through faith. But James tells us that what we do matters, because faith without works is dead. You can't have faith in God if you're unable or unwilling to show that faith through how you live your life. And we see that the Israelites here were showing their faith. And the faith they were showing was ugly to God, to the point that he was turning his back on them and allowing the world to have them. Are there any other comments or questions?
We see that God is long-suffering, not wishing that any should perish. And I remember back when we were studying Joshua, it started back in the days of Joshua, when they did not follow through on God's requirement that they run everybody out of the country. They settled for less than what God wanted. And yet God, through all this period of time, even though he has punished them off and on, he's always come back. But now they've gone so far that there's just no returning back. But God is long-suffering for us today. The time that we have on this earth, we better use wisely.
Agreed. Absolutely. God is a long-suffering, much more patient being than I am. I'll tell you that. Because my anger gets rankled real quick with some of the stuff I see in our society today. And I always have to find myself looking for verses that come from God about how to deal with that type of anger and frustration when I see a people that are turning their back on God. Or when we see people today who claim to be Christians, but they're making the same claim that the Israelites were in their time right here. They don't show themselves as Christians today. They just like to put the name on. They like to walk around with that, but they're not serving God the way that God would have them serve him. They want to cut parts and pieces of the new covenant out because they don't want to follow them. And when you see that happening, it just reminds me of this all over again. It reminds me of the Jews saying, "We're saved, we're saved," running into their walled city and into their temple, not knowing that doom was upon them. Any other comments or questions?